On the other coast, sea life is making a comeback. For the first time since the Second World War, harbor porpoises are showing up in growing numbers in San Francisco. Researchers are trying to understand why they've returned to the bay. Lauren Summer reports from member station KQED.
The walkway across the Golden Gate Bridge is almost always packed with people taking photos. But Bill Keener isn't here for snapshots of the stunning views.
There's a porpoise right here coming very, very close.
Keener is with Golden Gate Cetacean Research, a nonprofit group. He's aiming his massive telephoto lens at a dark shape in the water 200 feet below.
Here's a mother and a calf right here coming straight at us.
Harbor porpoises have dark gray backs, and they're about 5 feet long, smaller than most of their dolphin relatives.
Look at that. That one's on its side. The porpoise turned on its side and is spinning and it's feeding.
They're feeding in the middle of a busy shipping lane. Seeing this behavior is huge for Keener. Harbor porpoises are notoriously shy in the open ocean, but the fact that they're here at all is what's most remarkable.
All right, I'm going to try to get some photos of this one.
Keener and his colleagues have identified 250 porpoises with their photos by looking for unique scars on the animals. When they first started working on the bridge, the patrol officers took notice.
We're staring down into the water for hours. They start getting worried about us, but they know us now. They know what we're doing.
Of course, the big question is why harbor porpoises disappeared in the first place. Keener says the bay has always been porpoise habitat. Sightings were common until the 1930s.
We don't really have any reports from around World War II, and there was a lot of things going on in World War II that could have caused that.
San Francisco Bay became a wartime port. It was a major shipbuilding center.
Into fog-shrouded San Francisco Bay, where thousands lined the hills and piers, sailed 14 warships beneath crowd-jammed Golden Gate Bridge.
The Navy strung a 7-mile-long net underwater across the opening of the bay to keep out Japanese submarines. Hundreds of mines were planted in the waters outside the Golden Gate. But there's a bigger change that may have driven them away.
Clearing up a little, John.
It is clearing up.
This is good.
I'm heading toward the Golden Gate Bridge on a 22-foot boat with Keener and Jonathan Stern, a whale researcher at San Francisco State University. The bay we're gliding over today is a far cry from the bay of the 1950s and 60s. As the region boomed, so did water pollution.
I remember coming across the Bay Bridge when I was very young, and it would just smell. It would stink.
After the Clean Water Act was passed in 1972, the bay's water quality began to improve. But it took time for the food web to come back. And Stern says maybe the porpoises had to rediscover the bay.
Because over 60 years, we're talking about a number of generations of porpoises, so it's quite likely that San Francisco Bay as a habitat was sort of out of the institutional memory.
The boat slows down as we pass under the bridge.
There's porpoises between us and the South Tower at 200 yards.
Keener and Stern have a special permit to approach the porpoises. We wait, listening for them to surface.
I just heard one here. Here's a cow-calf pair close to the boat, and we'll hear this pop. The old-time sailors used to call them puffing pigs. That's the exhalation. Wow, that was 5 or 6 feet from the boat.
The porpoises seem calm around boats in the bay, which Stern says will let researchers study their life cycle and social structure.
It's one of those very few good news environmental stories, and it's like in our backyard. It gives one hope.
It also gives researchers a chance to study how porpoises will react to the America's Cup race, which comes to the Bay Area in 2 years. For NPR News, I'm Lauren Summer on San Francisco Bay.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News.
You know those used plastic bottles that you throw in the recycle bin? Shampoo, milk, juice, laundry detergent? Where do you think they go? No, they're not like the socks. They don't get lost somewhere. One way they're being reborn is a sort of hard plastic lumber. Maybe you've seen them on park benches, right? Those park benches are not really made out of wood sometimes. They're used to build bridges now. They can make bridges out of plastic bottles that are strong enough to hold cars and trains and even tanks on military bases. you can squeeze or bend or crush a plastic bottle in your hands. How do you get those throw-out bottles to support so much weight? And what else could we build with this recycled plastic? Well, now joining me now to talk about this is Jim Kirstein. He is Chief Technology Officer and founder of Axion International in New Providence, New Jersey. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks, Ira. How are you today?
How did you discover that these things would be good for making bridges and stuff out of it?
Well, you know, it really stems from all the bad publicity, and rightfully so, that plastics was getting in the recycling stream and more importantly in the waste stream. And we started taking recycled materials, working with Rutgers University here in New Jersey, and looking for things where we could take a negative, which was waste, into the environment and turn it around into a positive, which was developing long-lasting products that reduced maintenance, reduced planned obsolescence, and, you know, was really a useful thing. And so, again, in working with Rutgers and some other people, we started to advance this into railroad ties, bridges, military projects, marine projects, all that type of thing.
So do you actually start with the bottles and melt them down, or how does it begin?
There's now a whole collection process. Most people have some type of what we call curbside pickup, you know, where the bottles are put out and where the juice containers, detergent containers, all of that is put out at curbside. It gets collected. We buy certain types of material and put it together, and then you feed it through machinery and equipment, melt it down, and we can get it to take whatever shape we need it to, whether it's a round marine piling, an I-beam type of design, interlocking tongue and groove boards, all different types of things.
So what do you mix it with? To make it stronger, there must be other additives, correct?
It's actually 100% recycled plastics. The key to the technology that Rutgers developed was to put together certain materials that are strong and rugged and tough, but that might not be stiff enough on their own, and mix them with other materials that are other plastics that are very stiff but might be too brittle on their own. And in the right proportions and through the right processing techniques, they yield all types of material, all types of combinations. We have 13 patents or patents pending that we work with here. As you mentioned at the beginning of this segment, we built bridges that hold 130-ton railroads and railroad cars, M1 Abrams tanks for the military, that type of thing. It's really pretty exciting stuff.
So there is a bridge in Maine, which I think, given the weather, you know, and because it's made out of plastic, I imagine it holds up to road salt and corrosion and things and rust much better than a steel bridge.
That is one of the beauties of this stuff. It's basically got an indefinite lifespan, which, as I said before, is a real negative if you're burying it or dumping it out to sea, as has been done way too often. But it's a real positive if you're using it to cut down on maintenance and increase the longevity of products and designs. It's pretty, again, that's what makes it exciting for us.
Is it the same stuff that we see on the picnic tables and the park benches?
Not really. You know, just like there's different types of wood, and ipe from a rainforest is not the same as southern yellow pine, composite building materials have various formulations. Ours formulations are designed specifically to impact infrastructure projects and allow us to do long spans and create the type of stiffness and strength that's needed to do bridges and marinas and that type of thing. It's not a negative reflection on things like park benches and picnic tables. That's great recycling, but it does not have the same type of properties that our materials have.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Jim in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. Hi, Jim.
Hi, how you doing?
Hi there.
My question was, I was wondering if there was any evidence for deleterious health effects that might be estrogenic or carcinogenic from maybe compounds that will leak out of the plastic, especially when in long-term structures that are put in water where those compounds might leak out into the water.
It's a great question, Jim. There are, you know, so many different types of plastics out there. The ones that we use are non-toxic. There's been testing done where our marine piles have been driven in to waterways where formerly creosoted treated wood and things were used, and it actually allows marine life to come back into the area because there's so little impact on the environment, so little negative impact. There's a lot of positive impact.
Could you, you know, we talk about carbon fiber a lot now and making cars and things out of carbon fiber. Could you do it with plastics, recycled bottles instead?
Could you do?
Could you make the bodies, you know, car bodies out of, instead of carbon fibers, plastic?
You know, the potential is there, Ira, for all kinds of things. We don't put any limits on ourselves, but for right now, our focus is on you know, true infrastructure projects that again are looking for real long term benefits of the type that we can offer.
Could you actually run out of plastic bottles? If this really got going and a lot of bridges, and we know how much of the infrastructure is falling down all over America.
Sure, absolutely.
Could you run out of the raw material?
You know, I guess that's always a possibility, but we would be at a business level that would be so positively impacting the U.S. at that point and worldwide. I mean, right now, only about 17% of all plastics are actually recycled. So there's a long, long way to go before we get to that point. There's literally billions of pounds of material that are generated each year that are not recycled.
Let's go to Richard in New York, New York. Hi, Richard.
Yeah, hi. How are you doing?
Hi there.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment. I have inspected a number of structures made out of your composite material, pilings and decking and what have you. Staten Island, there's a pier near where the Staten Island Ferry comes in that was constructed. They did pile postings. I'm a diver. I do underwater construction, demolition, inspection. And the product didn't stand up very well to the weather, you know, with the white fiberglass reinforcement rods with the black piling. Comment on that?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, Rich, as I said before, you're right. I've seen those same failed projects. There are a variety of composites out there. The project that you're commenting on specifically was not one that we did. Our projects have been in service. We have bridges built for the military that go back about 14 years. We have railroad ties in service for over a dozen years. I mean, and I'm talking here hundreds of thousands of them. So we know the longevity of our product and how it works. Again, it's like comparing different types of wood. Just because something is a composite doesn't mean it's the same as our composite. You know, we've recently won awards, R&D 100, for the top new projects of the year. And again, we're getting reorders from customers that have utilized our product for years and years.
Well, what is it about your process or product that makes it so much better?
It's just the type of it's just the material formulation, and I'm not saying that to put down any competitors or anything like that, but our material formulation was derived specifically to yield longevity and performance in just this type of application.
And if I'm a bridge engineer wanting to build a bridge out of one of your using your items, I don't need to know anything special or special training or anything.
Not specifically any special training. Every material is different. Concrete bridges aren't built the same as steel. Steel is not built the same as wood. So neither are composite bridges, but for instance, McLaren Engineering in this area, Parsons Brinckerhoff, Balfour Beatty, major engineering concerns, have all designed with our materials.
All right, Jim. Thanks for taking time to talk about it today.
I appreciate it. Next time, maybe I can get on not after a Nobel Prize win.
We kept the audience for you.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
A great weekend.
Jim Kirstein is the Chief Technology Officer and founder of Axion International in Providence, New Jersey. Our program senior producer is Annette Heist. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our multimedia editor. Our producers are Christopher Intagliata and Misha Sarin and Anand and Leshu Bayak. Sam Flato is our production assistant. Neil Rausch, our technical director at the controls here in New York. If you missed any part of our program, go to iTunes. You can subscribe to our podcasts, audio and video. And we have a new improved Sci-Fry iPhone iPad app, the Sci-Fry B for Booster Edition. Go over to iTunes Store, download the Sci-Fry B. You can find it there by searching for it. Also, we have an Android one in the works, so we'll be going along with that too. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. Merry Christmas to you. And have a happy new year. I'm Ira Flato in New York. This is Science Friday. I am Ira Flato. Birding. Birding doesn't seem like a risky pastime, does it? What's the worst that could happen? Sunburn, a little rain, a little cold, lost binoculars? Well, not always. In 2010, Tim Gallagher, editor of Cornell Lab of Ornithology's Living Bird magazine, went in search of a rare woodpecker and was lucky to make it back alive. Our multimedia editor, Flora Lichtman, talked to Gallagher about it and has this story.
The imperial woodpecker is 2 feet tall. That's huge.
As far as we've been able to determine from the fossil record, there's never been a bigger woodpecker.
Its closest relation is the ivory-billed woodpecker, and like its cousin, the imperial is critically endangered, if not extinct. The last credible sightings were in the 90s, but Tim Gallagher thought that there's a chance a few still may exist, which is what drew him to the remote mountain range in Mexico where the woodpecker lives.
The Sierra Madre's always been a rugged, ungovernable place.
And that's where the story turns. An ordinary birding expedition, this was not.
It's heavy drug-growing country, holding AK-47s. The guy was trembling and all white as a sheet.
It just got crazier and crazier. It's like unbelievable.
That's basically how the story ends. But it really begins 50 years ago. With the late William Ryan.
William Ryan was a dentist who lived in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and he was also an amateur ornithologist. He was basically a bird fanatic, and he was really obsessed with the imperial woodpecker.
Tim Gallagher, by the way, is also really obsessed with the imperial woodpecker.
They're just so huge and powerful, swift flying, and their crests. I just get real pleasure from seeing them.
Ryan must have felt similarly. Back in the 50s, he made several self-funded trips to the mountains of Mexico to look for this bird, and he's the only one known to have captured the bird on film. But for many years, he kept the footage kind of under wraps.
The only opportunity he had to film this bird, he was on the back of a mule, so it was kind of jerky. So I think he was embarrassed by it, and he never really told many people about it.
Until an ornithologist by the name of Mark John Lammerting found a reference to the footage in some old letters and tracked Ryan down.
So he went there not knowing if this would be any good. He thought, at best, maybe there'll be an identifiable image of this bird, which will be nice.
When he got to the house, Ryan loads the reel on his 16-millimeter projector.
You're all set to go. Press your fingers. And I haven't looked at this for years and years and years.
That was recorded. That's when Mark John first saw that film. He turned his tape recorder on when the guy was playing it. And
right here now is where the... This is the ivory-billed cousin right here.
They started rolling this film. I mean, it was incredible. I mean, this bird's hitching up the tree. And
yeah, now this is back in the woods.
There it is. You see it?
Yeah, there it is, yeah.
Chipping off chunks of bark, throwing pieces of bark away that's bill. And
incredible.
It even takes off and flies three different times. And so in an 85-second film, it's just an incredible amount of stuff going on.
Wow.
Well, I thought that was lousy, but I had forgotten about those shots.
It was just such a tangible thing, something you could almost reach out and touch, you know. It was just like seeing a ghost. Watching that movie in many ways inspired me. I just want to go there and save that bird.
And that's what they tried to do. Gallagher and the ornithologist Lamerting got together an expedition to go to the Sierra Madre Occidental, to the exact same spot where that footage was shot 50 years ago.
Marchand knew a forester in the city of Durango in Mexico, which is about a five-hour drive from where we were going to go in the mountains, and he was real familiar with that area. It's heavy drug-growing country, opium and marijuana, which we didn't fully realize when we first went up there. Before we'd gone, a couple of months earlier, communicating with the forester, he said, it's still pretty safe in this part of Mexico, so you should be okay. But when we finally got down there, he said, you know, there's really like a wave of violence starting to sweep through here. And actually, we had some pretty scary things happen right from the start.
Like, for instance, the night before they were supposed to leave Durango.
We got a call from the forester, and he said he'd received an anonymous call from someone who knew exactly what we were doing and when we were going and was really furious about it. In fact, one of the Mexican scientists who was going to go with us, he dropped out of the expedition at that point. And so suddenly it was like, should we not go, or what's happening? You know, we were so close. It was like our excitement level was so high. I knew if we left, no one would go to check that area in our lifetimes. And I just thought, we got to go. And we decided we were going to go. But we had our first bad encounter the next day as we were driving up there. This dark truck came up behind us and then came racing by, and all the guys in it were holding AK-47s. And they matched the description of some people who murdered someone in another village about a week ago. By the time we left, it felt more like the mountains of Afghanistan than Mexico. And, you know, three houses were burned, and a man was abducted by, you know, from a little village, and all the villagers had to put their money together to buy this guy back. And it's just insane. You know, I mean, what are they going to do the next time someone gets grabbed?
How did you guys stay safe? What was your strategy?
We didn't really have a strategy. We just tried not to bother anyone and went with our business.
Which, remember, started out at least as a mission to find a woodpecker. So that's what they tried to do. And one of their tricks was this.
We play these recordings of an ivory-billed woodpecker because their voice is supposed to be just like an ivory-bill. It sounds like a loud toot of a child's toy horn.
They were hoping for a toot in return.
Rumors still do come out of there of, you know, lone imperial woodpeckers. But in all the places we went, we didn't get any response.
They never did spot the bird on that trip. Gallagher says logging has destroyed much of the imperial's habitat. And he heard from people who live there that 50 years ago there were extermination campaigns by loggers who thought the birds threatened the timber. Since then, new threats have emerged.
I'll tell you one of the worst moments for me. We were warned against crossing the Rio Taxacaringa, and on the other side, the CETAS controlled it, which is one of the worst drug cartels. And one day we're on the top of this cliff looking across the canyon, and there were people out there burning these old-growth trees, and they were going to destroy that forest so they could, you know, plant more opium poppies. And there was nothing we could do about it. It wouldn't have mattered if there were imperial woodpeckers over there. I'm almost glad I didn't see one because it would have just made me sick. You wouldn't know what to do. The Mexican government can't go up there. It's too dangerous, you know. And I'm a real optimistic person about just about everything I do, and it just became so depressing. You know, at the end, we really did not know if we were going to get out of there. I even took the memory cards out of my cameras and my voice recorders and things, and I put them in the little hip pocket on my jeans just in case, you know, we got robbed or murdered. At least what I'd gotten would exist, you know.
What started out as a quest to save a bird became a trip about Gallagher's own survival.
Luckily, we made it out of there. But then the next day, we arranged to meet the forester in the city of Durango out in the park, and we were going to have breakfast together. And he walks up to us, and he's just he's shaking, like, and he just hugs us both tightly. And he said, you know, if anything would have happened to you, I never would have forgiven myself. And he said that that night before we drove out, he and his wife got down on their knees and, you know, prayed to God for our safety and everything. By that time, we were all just standing in that park crying, you know, but it was awful.
Gallagher isn't planning to go back anytime soon, he says. But he didn't know that right away. After all, he'd spent years researching this bird. He'd made half a dozen trips to Mexico in the last 2 years.
It was hard to back away from it. I was really, really interested in the work, and I loved interviewing the people. And I think about the bird. It's too dangerous. It's too, you know, I've got kids at home that I need to raise.
So. Which for Gallagher may mean being haunted indefinitely by a ghost bird 3,000 miles away. For Science Friday, I'm Flor Lichtman.
If you want to see the only documented footage of the imperial woodpecker, check out our video pic from a few weeks ago. It's on our website at sciencefriday.com.